Well, I appreciate very much being invited, and it's been very nice visiting. Very interesting place. Okay. So a few things that are very well known. We have an extraordinarily good theory of physics, fundamental theory of physics, the standard model plus general relativity. And I want to consider it as an effective quantum field theory, the combination. So the standard model, one can obviously consider as an effective quantum field theory. I think it's perfectly reasonable to consider the general relativity as an effective quantum field theory because at the scales we can investigate, which are huge multiple of the Planck scale, quantum gravity looks like classical gravity. So it isn't saying much, but what it does is it unifies the formalism. So the formalism that works is an effective quantum field theory. Okay, so that's the only content of that move. And there are only a few things left out that we know of. Plenty of puzzles like why some numbers are tiny and so on, but the actual physical phenomena, as far as I know, there are only dark matter, neutrino mixing, and some parts of CP violation that remain mysterious in the standard model and general relativity, unexplained. Okay, so I'm interested in the possibility of coming up with a more fundamental theory of fundamental physics. And this has, been going on for a long time, at least as long as since grand unification. And the structure of the enterprise is, as I see it, that you come up with some formalism from which the standard model and general relativity follow, in some sense. I use the word produce because I'm, as you'll see, I am obsessed with the notion of mechanism. And then you predict something that can be tested to see if the proposed formalism actually describes the real world. So we have plenty of examples in the past, and I listed two of them, general relativity, which was from Newtonian gravity and special relativity, and grand unification from the standard model. And the point of listing, especially the second one, was I wanted to remind you of the nature of the prediction that grand unification made. It didn't predict that the standard model would be here. There's a large collection of grand unified theories, and they all give effective field theories at the scales we've investigated. The prediction is conditional. It says, if this more fundamental mechanism produces the standard model, then it also produces proton decay. Okay? And I find that a very appealing form because I've grown, I was more optimistic when I was young. The prospects of predicting the standard model, the couplings, the field content, seem to me remote. Not impossible, but remote. But this sort of conditional prediction might be feasible, more feasible anyway. Okay, so nothing's worked since the standard model in the early 1970s, since the standard model was finished. So, you know, like I say, it's reasonable to give up for now and do other stuff and wait for more experimental guidance. Okay. But I'm stubborn. I'm probably too old to go do other things. So I'm interested in what can be done. Okay. But I'm suggesting, especially to the young people, that when there is a track record like this, everything should be reconsidered. So I'm recommending critical examination of the assumptions that have been made. And as you'll see, I'm especially concerned about the mathematical idealizations that have been used, and the truisms. By truism, I mean an assumption that people don't even think of as an assumption. It's so obvious, obviously true. And I think that one, you know, when if one looks carefully, we're in physics. The only justification for true is physical evidence. Okay, so this was specially crafted for the current audience. The one truism that I think ought to be questioned is that gravity should be quantized. And I'm sure everybody has heard both of these arguments. The huge number, the ratio between the scale we have access to experimentally and the scale where quantum gravity is going to be observable, that huge number just means it's a very naive point, but it seems to me just not going to happen. A check on any proposed theory of quantum gravity. So if you can't check it, it is in physics. No, I don't want to argue this. I'll argue it afterwards. I'll argue it afterwards.
That
you're using. And, okay. Hey, I don't want to argue it now. Okay. So, the main point I'm making here. The main point I'm making here is this log plot. This log plot in scale. So I will be using, when I talk about scales, I will be always talking about distances, just to be unambiguous. But we normally talk about energies. So the conversion, of course. So in this chart, I put in both. Okay? So we have experimental evidence down to on the order of 1 over 10 to the third GeV. I wrote that as L experimental, the length scale at which we have experimental evidence. And everything we know says that at larger distances, quantum mechanics describes, in particular, effective quantum field theory describes almost everything, right? Below that scale where we have evidence, we have no idea what is happening. Everything is extrapolation. So the question mark in there, that is on not on the log scale, but on the log scale. We know nothing. Okay? And the real purpose of the slide was not the comment so much there, but just to start to look at that chart. Okay, so I'm approaching this question of how to make a more fundamental theory. I'm not after the fundamental theory. I wouldn't know I'd found it. Okay, I'm just want to think conservatively and relatively modestly. Okay, I want to think what would be more, what do we need, the minimum we need for a more fundamental theory. So I think about the kinds of experiments we do to probe fundamental physics, and they are essentially, in one way or another, scattering experiments. Okay, we have some sort of experimental region of a size L. Again, I'm talking distances from now on. And we have a good quantum mechanical model for what happens at bigger distances. So we have a model for our experimental apparatus, the machine that sends in the beam. We have a model for the detectors that detect what comes out. And they are well described by quantum mechanics, by quantum field theory. What's happening at smaller distances, we don't know. And we describe what's going on there, not with a quantum mechanical model, not with a Hamiltonian, but by the scattering amplitudes. We take states in our known quantum field theory, incoming states, send them in, outcomes, outgoing states in our known quantum field theory, and the scattering amplitudes are the information we have about short distance physics. So, the minimal formalism to describe this situation is an effective quantum field theory. Effective quantum field theory is quantum field theory with an ultraviolet cutoff. And here I'm using distances for everything. So it's an so L is the ultraviolet cutoff of the effective quantum field theory. And for physics at smaller distances, we need what I'm calling an effective S matrix. It's an S matrix that describes scattering in an apparatus of size L. Okay? Now, just as effective quantum field theory is, how to say it, a realistic version of the mathematical idealization of continuum quantum field theory, right? Continuum quantum field theory is a mathematical object. We have axioms, right? And in that, you can calculate correlation. Well, you have correlation functions of fields to arbitrarily small distance scale. But an effective quantum field theory is what we really can do. Put it in a computer with a cutoff, right? Well, I'm proposing that we regard S matrices the same way. We're all taught in quantum field theory that you get an S matrix by going to time minus infinity for the incoming state and time plus infinity for the outgoing state. That's an idealization. Nobody can do that. And they certainly don't do that at CERN. You go from some early time to some later time, and you do it inside a box. Okay? So I'm calling an S matrix with an infrared cutoff, L, that's the size of the experimental region. Okay? And so the minimal formalism is quantum field theory at distances greater than L, S matrix at distances less than L. That's the proposal. But what's L? L is a sliding scale. As time goes on, we get better and better at physics. We push L, well, not we, but the experimentalists push L smaller and smaller. So here's a picture of what I have in mind, again, in this. So we have some sliding scale L, and the only constraint is that it should be a huge number, 10 to the 16th, 10 to the 15th, 14th, 13th, 12th, in units of the Planck scale, in fundamental units. And at distances roughly L and larger, the world is described by quantum field theory, effective quantum field theory, and at smaller distances by scattering amplitudes with respect to the states of that quantum field theory. Right? They're what you're sending in and getting, finding, coming out. Okay? But there has to be a consistency condition. As you change L, make L smaller, go to some L prime that's smaller than L, right? The new physics, the new description at that smaller scale has to be consistent with your previous description. So the quantum field theory with the smaller cutoff, L prime, remember, cutoff is distance in my, for today. With the smaller distance cutoff, has to, right, we know how to get the effective quantum field theory at a larger distance. We run the renormalization group, Wilsonian renormalization group, if you like. Okay? So the new, better quantum field theory has to produce the old one at distances where they're both applicable. Okay. Now, the same has to be true of the S matrix in the other direction. The S matrix at the bigger distance, right? If you're doing a scattering, this is, you know, hand waving. You're doing a scattering experiment with a big region. You create, you could mock up the incoming states in a smaller region by fiddling with your incoming states outside. So you can produce the effective S matrix in the smaller experimental region from the effective S matrix in the bigger experimental region. Okay? So I coined, if you like, the term S matrix renormalization group for that process, for that condition. And I use the mathematical containment sign to indicate that the object with more information contains the object with less information. Okay. And then the new description has to agree with, so in the new description at L prime, shorter, smaller experimental region, right, we have quantum field theory that describes everything outside, and part of what's outside is the scales between our new region and the bigger region. So we have to be able to explain with this new quantum field theory the S matrix that we had earlier when we only knew things out at size L, okay? So given these consistency conditions, this formal structure does everything we need, and I think not anymore. And it does not posit that there is quantum mechanics all the way down. At short distances, at any given scale, in where L, the scale of our quantum mechanical knowledge, at shorter distances, we're only doing scattering experiments, and we only know S matrix elements. We are not assuming a Hamiltonian all the way down. Now, we learned that you get an S matrix from a Hamiltonian. And one of the presumptions that people tend to make is that's the only way. If you have an S matrix, there must be a quantum mechanical Hamiltonian somewhere.
What's the definition of an S matrix?
scattering, it's a unitary operator between Hilbert spaces, incoming to outgoing. Well, with the cutoff, you have to be careful. It's unitary up to corrections because of a cutoff. Okay. Between incoming states and outgoing states, but here we have an infrared cutoff, so it's going to be unitary up to corrections. You know, if you don't hit the cutoff, you'll maintain unitarity, right? You'll preserve probability for any process that doesn't collide with the walls of the chamber. The Hilbert space is the Hilbert space of the quantum field theory, because that's what you use to produce the beam and what you use to detect the beam. So the states are the states of the quantum field theory, and the knowledge, but now you're sending them in to a region, you know, where the quantum field theory doesn't apply, so you don't know what happens between the time you send them in and the time you detect them.
When you say it's not a Hamiltonian, you mean this map is not the exponential of
a
Hamiltonian?
It's not the exponential of a Hamiltonian. Yeah. Because you get an S matrix by running a Hamiltonian for infinite time. The idea is that that all we have is the S matrix, okay, for the short distance processes.
So if you said unitary map, what is it?
I am trying to push the notion that we of avoiding idealizations. So here we have an infrared cutoff on the S matrix. So it's unitary up to the infrared cutoff.
You can make mathematical sense. I mean, in terms of a definition.
The way you make mathematical sense of a cutoff quantum field theory. Your correlation functions look continuum up to corrections that are small with respect to the cutoff. Right? It's not a continuum function, it's a function.
So there's a measure to measure small.
All right.
It's a more practical definition than the fundamental
definition. Yeah. You will notice that I am using the language pragmatic, produce, mechanism. I'm definitely not interested in mathematical perfection. I'm interested in something that works up to, you know.
For most people here, it's just that people don't really know what an S matrix is or what you mean by an S matrix. So I'm trying to make it clear.
You make a state in CERN of incoming particles, you detect a state of outgoing particles. Okay? Now, there's a bit of non-realism there in that I'm talking about amplitudes and what you really detect are probabilities, but we're familiar with that bit of quasi-realism in quantum field theory. You were asking something?
Yeah, listen, I'm not sure I understand the distinction, because what kind of experiment are you talking about here where you have a quantum field theory, but you don't know what's going on?
CERN. We have a quantum field theory of the standard model. We can describe, we use it to make a beam of protons and antiprotons, you know, whatever, or, right? So our existing quantum field theory that works down to like 1 over 10 to the third GeV, that describes the machine that makes the beam, and all the time development of the state of these converging particles, right? But once they get to within this, you know, much tinier region, we have no idea what's going on. We don't, but we measure, using our quantum field theory, we measure what comes out, okay?
But the assumption is the quantum field theory does describe what's happening. And of course, the predictions of standard model have been, you know.
The standard model does not describe what's happening beyond roughly 10 to the third GeV.
But the S matrix that you get from standard model can be tested and confirmed itself, right?
Yeah. But we have no idea how long it applies.
So what I'm trying to understand is how do you
So all we have at smaller distance is the S matrix. Now it might, if it corresponds to the standard model, we've pushed the standard model's validity, domain of validity farther.
Yeah,
if something new comes up,
that will be the logical thing to do as far as you can get.
If it works, it works. If it does, but we have no idea now. We've learned a little bit over the last few years, and it works much better at smaller distances than people thought it would, right? But beyond where they've gone so far, we don't know what's going to happen, and nobody knows, right? If the S matrix that you get agrees with the standard model, then you know how to push it. If you get some new particle that you can add and get a beyond the standard model effective quantum field theory, that is what, then you go to some, now at some smaller L prime, you have a new effective field theory, right? From which the standard model is derived as an effective theory. And now you have a new unknown zone where everything is S matrix, okay?
But the main aspect that would not work, I mean, if it is just a matter of a new particle you just added and you still have the same formula as far as the shape theory is concerned, the part what you would have concerns about is if you reach the Planck scale.
You came in late. I was making the remark that nobody's going to reach the Planck scale. So we don't have to worry about that.
I don't know. You can try to push, try to see what.
Why should you? Nobody's ever going to be able to measure anything. That was the remark I made. If you can't measure it, you can't tell if it's right or wrong. So it's not physics.
How can you tell anything else is right or wrong?
Because if you have to make a prediction, like grand unification made a prediction of proton decay. And you see if that comes true.
Anyway, I mean, I don't see anything wrong with pushing the formula as high as possible.
Yeah, I think it's a pointless enterprise. Look, I'll put back the slide that I started with. Okay, below the scale where we have experimental evidence, which is 10 to the 16 times the Planck distance, we have no idea what's going on. So to assume that it's quantum mechanics all the way down is presumptuous, right? Of course, you're free to do it, but why? Why would you do it? If you were up here at 1 millimeter, the last 10 to the 16th in scale, you would have said the same about classical mechanics. Let's push it all the way down. And it would have
say that for any other proposal.
Right. So a proposal, I'm fine. If you have a proposal about physics all the way down to the Planck scale that has a chance of making a testable prediction, go at it. I'm happy with that, really happy with that. I'd be excited. Okay.
Can I say something else? Okay. Your assumption that the S matrix at the smaller length is contained in the S matrix at the larger length, doesn't that implicitly assume that the S matrix is a consequence of a local unitary quantum field theory?
I don't think so.
I cannot make
and the structure I'm going to try to describe to you does not make that assumption and yet has that consistency condition. Maybe. If you could, then it would be justified to assume quantum field theory.
All the way.
Yeah, but I don't think so. I don't see why. Okay, somebody else?
I'll let you continue.
Okay.
We can accelerate the size of the cells. We can do experiments at the Planck edge. Otherwise, we can't.
Okay.
And that's the bottom line.
I'll be looking from somewhere when that happens. Okay.
So, I'm sorry for being upset.
Yeah.
So is the direction you're going making some proposal related to S matrix without having to say?
Let's see if I can, I'll put, okay. The structure that I'm proposing is that you have an S matrix for short distance and effective quantum field theory for long distance. where the distance scale, L, the intermediate distance scale, gets smaller and smaller as progress is made, right? And I'm proposing that that's the minimal formalism for a more fundamental theory. It does not presuppose anything all the way down. Okay. Oh, wait. I'm not done yet. Okay. So I'm going to, I want just self-indulgent, I'm going to do this historically, how this came about. Oh, wait. Okay. So it came about, this line of thought came about over a very long period, mostly in the last century. And the end result of it was proposal of a very definite mechanism, a certain two-dimensional nonlinear model whose target manifold is a bit unusual. The space of space-time fields with a cutoff, which also can be interpreted as the space of 2D coupling constants of a string world sheet. And I'll be describing this model, but the main point of it is, of proposing it is, it's an actual mechanism, a machine that produces that structure that I described and suggested was the minimal needed to be a more fundamental theory. Okay, so the reasons for suggesting that it's worth exploring is, first of all, it produces the structure that I just was describing. But that's a very, semi-philosophical justification. I mean, I think it's the argument that that's the minimal structure needed, formal structure needed, is a pretty good one, but those sorts of reasons don't count in physics. The interesting thing about this mechanism is that I'll describe how it produces a quantum field, an effective quantum field theory. It isn't necessarily exactly the same as canonical quantization. It's a two-dimensional quantum field theory mechanism, and there are non-perturbative two-dimensional effects that might arise that give something non-canonical in the effective quantum field theory that it produces. And I am not claiming these are observable effects, but it would make possible a kind of conditional prediction. I don't think any possibility of showing, in what sense this model produces the standard model plus GR. But what might be possible is to say that if it produces the standard model plus GR, then it will produce also these non-canonical effects. And if they can be calculated and turned out to be observable, it would be a way to justify this whole enterprise. I really don't think that, unless one can do something like that, I don't think any enterprise in fundamental physics is physics.
So is the computation mechanism in the lambda model, is it basically what we learned in string theory, vertex operators?
Wait a second, I'm going to explain.
Okay.
All right, so it was a line of thought that started 40 years ago. So the beginnings of it were the renormalization of the general two-dimensional nonlinear model. So I don't know how much people learn about this, but it's a two-dimensional field theory. So Z is a complex coordinate on the plane. So we are looking at you. Everything I'm doing is Euclidean signature, okay? I am completely postponing Wick rotation to the end of and then not touching it. Okay, so don't interrupt about that issue. Talk about it later. So Z is a complex coordinate on the complex plane, a two-dimensional space-time, Euclidean space-time, and you have a field X that takes values in some manifold. M, and the nonlinearity refers to the fact that the action has arbitrary powers of X if you expand, but it can be encoded in a natural way in a Riemannian metric, G mu nu, on the manifold. And then, since this metric encodes the 2D couplings of the model, think of them, you know, expand G mu nu around X naught in Taylor series in some coordinates. And you get a bunch of infinitely many vertices whose coefficients are the Taylor series of the metric, right? So in that sense, all the modes of the metric are coupling constants in the 2D quantum field theory. And you have a renormalization group. And one can calculate, and the change with the 2D scale of the metric on the target manifold M is given by the Ricci tensor plus corrections of order curvature squared. The renormalization can be done covariantly, so with respect to diffeomorphisms of M, so you're guaranteed to get
trillion variant. So basically, there is a dimension introduced, right, which is
the 2D scale.
Alpha prime.
Yeah. I'm working in dimensionless units everywhere. So G mu nu is just, and I'm eliding the difference between the Planck scale and the string scale.
The issue is, if you care or not, I don't know, is that an approach like that, the target space, would be geodesically incomplete.
I am working in the Euclidean signature with, and I'm assuming everything as simple as possible. So the target manifold is a compact manifold. In this picture, take M to be a compact Euclidean signature manifold. Okay. Okay. So back then, that equation, that renormalization group equation, I found enormously exciting because the 2D renormalization group drives the model to a solution of beta equals zero, which is, in this model, R mu nu equals zero, something very close to Einstein's equation. If you thought about the manifold M as space-time. So it was a mechanism. The 2D renormalization group looks like a mechanism that produces field theory. Now, it produces classical field theory, and it's not exactly Einstein's equation. It's just like it, you know, close to it, okay? And if one wanted to be grandiose, you would think about things, you know, this would be a mechanical answer to the question, where do the laws of physics come from, okay? I spent some time doing philosophy before I got into physics, and I don't, this notion that you're going to decide the laws of physics by understanding the deep principles that tell you what the laws of physics should be. Physics is mechanical, so I want a mechanism that produces field theory. And here was a mechanism that did that, or, you know, was close to doing that. All right, now from a more a practical point of view, by this time in the late 90s, it was quite clear there are just way too many effective quantum field theories. So we really did need and grand unification wasn't working. So we needed a mechanism beyond the principle of symmetry plus the renormalization group.
it's going to ask, of course, it's not the answer to the question because it lacks the right-hand side. It's a vacuum answer to the question. Can you get using this?
No, that's what I mean by not quite on. Right. Wait. Just wait a minute. Okay. So in the early 1980s, this equation, beta equals zero, in the 2D nonlinear model got incorporated into string theory. So the recipe of, I'm talking about when I say string theory, I mean old-fashioned worldsheet string theory. I'm disregarding everything since then. You need a scale-invariant worldsheet for the recipe to work. That you get an S matrix from string, from the worldsheet. So scale invariance is the beta function equals zero. So it's a consistency condition in string theory. Okay. And then in those days, you thought of a string background as the two-dimensional quantum field theory of the worldsheet. Solving beta equals zero. And to answer your question, it was figured out how to add degrees of freedom besides this capital X to the world sheet, such and a few additional couplings besides the metric coupling, so that the 2D coupling constants were encoded in a metric, gauge fields, scalar fields, fermion fields, and the beta equals zero equation of this more elaborate 2D system was a physical classical field theory equation, okay? So, and then the S matrix of the string recipe at low momentum agreed with the canonical quantization of that classical field theory. All right.
What I mean is, do you actually get the answer equation with the right
team? Yes. Yes. Okay. Now, at that point, what bothered me was I wanted a mechanism that would produce quantum field theory. A consistency condition isn't a mechanism. And then I wanted quantum field theory, not classical field theory, and beta equals zero is a classical field theory equation. And then I don't want the background to be described by a classical solution of field theory. The background for string scattering should be the state of a quantum field theory. Quantum mechanics is what describes the world where we do scattering. And finally, I didn't want this idealized string S matrix. I wanted one that describes scattering inside a real experiment. I wanted an S matrix with an effective S matrix. Okay, so those were all questions that led off, the mainstream went off doing other things. And especially in my view, I was avoiding some misleading idealizations. Especially this one of the string S matrix is a theory of everything. Okay, now in the appendix of these slides, I talk a little about philosophical motivation. I'm not going to inflict it on you, so I won't talk about, elaborate on this. But the relation, I went to grad school in Berkeley, which was the home church of the S matrix, the mother church of the S matrix program. So the notion of this Heisenberg, Wheeler, Chu S matrix philosophy is percolating inside for a long time. And the part of it that says at short distance we only observe scattering, I think is spot on. But the part of it says that the whole universe is an S matrix is nonsense. Okay.
Now, the fact that this approach produced an infinite set of S matrices,
yeah,
and so called,
yeah,
landscape.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if the landscape makes sense. I don't care. But this mechanism that I'm describing to you, the space of 2D field theories is huge. Even the ones that would work as effective string background. And this, as I'll be pointing out, this lambda model produces a measure on that space. And that's way too big for me to contemplate. That's why I talk about conditional prediction. If some of that measure is concentrated near the standard model, then will it produce something you can test? That's relatively modest, and I can handle that. If that works, if there's a prediction and it can be tested and it's met, then we're motivated to consider deep questions about where other possible, okay? But until then, who cares? It's just pointless to, okay? I'm trying to be as pragmatic as possible, okay? All right, so now this lambda model, it took me a long time to think out what it should do, why it should be there. I'm going to describe it for you, and then I'm going to tell you the rationale. Okay, so the language I'm using is, I have a 2D quantum field theory of the world sheet, anyone. And I'm looking at the nearby 2D quantum field theories. They're parameterized by some coupling constants, lambda I, which couple to some 2D fields, phi I. And if you know about conformal field theory, the field state correspondence says that the fields are the same as states on a tiny circle in the radial quantization. So the states I write as kets and bras labeled by the corresponding field. Okay, and if this quantum field theory describes, some large space-time dimensions, which I'm going to conditionally assume. Right, then these fields are made from the coupling constants are the modes of fields in space-time, a metric and other fields in space-time. And they are labeled by a space-time momentum, P of I, for each field I. Okay, and again, I'm in the Euclidean signature, Wick rotate later. Okay, and you get the nearby quantum field theory by inserting in your correlation functions, the exponential of phi I times lambda I integrated. Okay, it's a standard picture in quantum field theory in all dimensions, except for that states on the circle. Then you have, in higher dimension, it would be a tiny sphere that put in, okay. So these coupling constants lambda I are local coordinates on the space of 2D quantum field theories. Now, this is 2D quantum field theory. There's a renormalization group flow given by a beta function, beta I, which depends on all the couplings. And you can write it as a linear term plus higher order terms. And the linear term tells you the dimension of the coupling constant. So lambda I has dimension minus delta I, which is some number. Now, if you were doing that original general nonlinear model, you'd be expanding the Ricci tensor in the modes of the metric, and the delta I's would be eigenvalues of the linearization of the Ricci tensor, right? And in flat, if it were around a flat space time, this would be roughly p squared plus stuff, okay? D'Alembertian, Laplacian on the manifold M. But abstractly, it's just the scaling dimensions of the coupling constants. And any quantum field theory is going to have this structure, any 2D quantum field theory. Okay. If the scaling dimension of the coupling is zero, then the perturbation is scale invariant, and you get a nearby 2D conformal field theory. Or you get a nearby solution of beta equals zero. Okay? So the 2D renormalization group is driving you to this submanifold where beta equals zero. Right? Because all the scaling dimensions of the coupling constants are negative. That is another huge advantage of the string world sheet quantum field theories. Because a positive dimension coupling constant in 2D would correspond to a tachyon in spacetime. And if you don't do the special 2D field theories that will serve as string world sheets, you can't get this condition that all the delta I's are positive, that all the coupling constants have negative scaling dimension. Okay? So that was one of the several reasons, and again, it's in the appendix, a little more detail about that, for thinking that string theory was a useful mechanism to make an S matrix, right, at short distance. Now, apropos earlier, string theory is a mechanism that produces an S matrix without having as input a Hamiltonian. Now, one of the truisms of string theory has been, but there must be a Hamiltonian because there's an S matrix. I don't know. Hasn't worked out.
Is it a Hamiltonian?
No, there isn't.
Of course there is, for the degrees of freedom that you have in any given string theory.
No. There's some terribly horrible string field theory, contorted perturbation theory that you have no idea the meaning of. No, I don't consider that a Hamiltonian. You have no idea what loop corrections are going to look like. No, come on.
It's the same thing of what you're saying in a different language.
No, it is not.
It is.
No. I am not presupposing a Hamiltonian that the string S matrix comes from. Oh yeah, people are free to presuppose what they want, but the subtext of commenting on that number 45 was pretty clear. All right, now, again, I am interested in practical quantum field. Effective quantum field theory. So I said, okay, I'm going to make, I want the 2D world sheet quantum field theory to be an effective quantum field theory. I'm going to investigate what that implied. So we have a scale of the world sheet, mu, and we have a cutoff distance much smaller than mu inverse. Okay? And now, if you try to do the string recipe, but with a cutoff, so you're going to have strings propagating, that's a cylinder, which you can represent as the conformally as the annulus, the unit circle with a little hole around the origin. But now that the size of that, and you integrate over the size of that hole, but the integral's cut off by capital lambda. What you get, the propagator, on this cylinder, you're going to insert a complete set of states on the circle at one end and a complete set at the other. Those are the bras and kets up there. And then you're going to integrate over the length, which is this tau. And in the picture where this is the annulus, the Hamiltonian for this is the dilation operator. So you're going to end up with the scaling dimension in the exponent. And the cutoff is going to appear in a cutoff in the length of the cylinder. I'm not going to go through the calculation in any more detail. It's not that tough. You do that integral, and you get not 1 over the scaling dimension, which, remember, the scaling dimension, delta I, is roughly p squared. So that would be the pole in the physical propagator. But you get a cutoff version of that, where the cutoff has the form e to the minus l squared delta of I, which is the ratio of the 2D scales, that's what's up there in the top, to the power minus delta I. So this number L is simply given by the square root of the logarithm of the cutoff. Okay?
So is mu squared basically the alpha prime
power? No. This is the 2D scale. 2D scale. Alpha prime is the scale of the space-time metric. Because you need a scale to do a calculation. The 2D scale. We're doing 2D string theory calculations. We're in 2D. We're not caring where these phi i's came from at this point. Okay. So the modes that where the propagator looks like 1 over delta I, those will be the ones that propagate. If delta I gets very small, you just get L squared. There's a cutoff. So it'll look like 1 over delta I just if delta I is bigger than L to the minus 2. Remember, this little delta of I is roughly space-time momentum squared. So L is, it says that only the high momentum modes, higher than 1 over L, or the modes at distances, at wavelengths less than L, are the only ones that propagate in this effective string S matrix. Okay? So the 2D cutoff worldsheet gives you an effective string S matrix with an infrared cutoff L. Just what I wanted for that formal structure that I described to you in the beginning. And as I mentioned, it was more studying this that started giving me the idea. That's what one really wants. Okay? Okay, now, but we have another question. What are the coupling constants for this world sheet? The effective coupling constants. Right? What is the background? These describe the background. Okay. Well, you have to put in every possible coupling at the cutoff scale and see what has an effect at the macroscopic scale mu. So you run the 2D renormalization group. And, you know, as long as you're not too far away, it's given by the scaling dimension of the coupling constants. So it's the ratio of the cutoff scale lambda to mu to a power, which is the dimension of the coupling constant. That means that if the dimension of the coupling constant is sufficiently negative, it's just driven to zero at scale mu. It won't have any effect on the string S matrix. It isn't a parameter of the background. Okay? But if the dimension of the coupling constant is less than L to the minus 2, then it doesn't get driven to zero. It stays significant, and it describes a change of the background. So the background is described by the couplings lambda I, which have small momentum. wavelengths bigger than L. So what's happened by looking at the effect, an effective world sheet, is that we're separating the two-dimensional modes into string modes, which are short distance, the vertex operators that describe short distance physics and propagate in the S matrix, and the low momentum modes that describe the background. Now, this move, I am not going to justify until later. So just go along with it. These coupling constants are just constants, right? You could have pulled them out of the integral over the phi I in the insertion that describes a perturbation of the 2D system. Now, let them depend on position on the world sheet. Those are called, in quantum field theory, sources. Coupling constants that depend on position. And now, let these fluctuate at scales less than the 2D cutoff distance, with a natural nonlinear model governing their fluctuations, where so lambda, remember, takes values in the space of 2D field theories, right? Of effective 2D field theories. Okay? So the number of lambdas is going to be finite, but big, but finite. So there's some target manifold that the lambdas are coordinates on, and we're doing the nonlinear model with that target.
Why are they finite?
Well, like I said, think of a world sheet in a manifold M, where M, and to keep everything regular, M is compact. Okay. So the eigenvalues of the Laplacian, or some generalized Laplacian, right? They're going to be discrete. They're going to be bounded below, and we have a cutoff, so they're bounded above. So it's a finite number. Okay.
But the universe isn't compact.
No. So but you could look. All I care about is, like I said, at this point, I want to, you could imagine, the measure that I'm about to describe is, maybe some of it is concentrated in a very large manifold. We can't tell that from non-compact, okay? But like I said, I'm postponing deep questions because I want to know the theory has some evidence before I'm going to waste my brain cells, my remaining few on that. Okay, so the action of this model, right? It's a nonlinear model with the target space, the effective 2D field theories of the world sheet. There's a natural metric on the space of 2D quantum field theories, Zamolodnikov metric, it's sometimes called. I'm multiplying it by 1 over the square of the string coupling constant for reasons that I will justify. And, right, so that's lambda is fluctuating. But what happens when lambda fluctuates? Well, the insertion, lambda is describing a nearby quantum field theory by this insertion. So this is the functional integral you're doing. Okay, so again, I need pictures. The idea is you have a 2D cutoff distance, big lambda inverse, and we have lambda model fluctuations at short distance, and that produces an effective quantum field theory at larger 2D distances that we use to make the string to run the string recipe. Okay, now the justification.
So you don't have an idea yet, I suppose, about what the metric is on the lambda space?
Yeah, it's the natural metric on the space of 2D quantum field, the Zamolodchikov metric, it's called. It's given by the, if you like, the propagator, the cylinder diagram. But there are a lot of ways to describe it. But it's perfect, it's completely mathematically natural. But it's dictated by the rationale I'm about to describe. Okay? Putting this 2D mechanism in at short distance is designed in order to implement what I call the S matrix renormalization group for the string S matrix. Okay? The idea is that to implement this S matrix, you're going to want to integrate out tiny handles in the world sheet. Right? And I have an argument which, a very simple calculation that's in the appendix, I'm not going to show it to you, that says that introducing these fluctuations of the lambdas at short distance is equivalent to integrating out the froth of tiny handles. So the mechanism is designed so the string S matrix with cutoff corresponding to L prime. Now I have L prime bigger than L, I'm sorry. It should be the other way. But anyway, the S matrix at the bigger space-time infrared cutoff will imply the S matrix at the smaller cutoff. Okay. And it's a very simple calculation, but in the spirit of 2D physics, you can conclude a lot by very simple calculations of logarithms. Okay, now what makes it really, to my mind, made it seem useful. When you have a 2D nonlinear model, there are actually two pieces of data you need to give. One is the metric on the target. That's up in the action. But there's this functional measure, d lambda, which I just wrote as d lambda and didn't really describe. But what is it? Think of a lattice version, a 2D lattice, right? You have a variable at each point, which takes values in your target manifold, and you have to integrate over it. So you need a measure at each z, at each point z, a measure on the target manifold. Okay? And I called that back in the old days the a priori measure, because the stat-mech people used to call, in the Ising model, at every point you have plus or minus, and using 1/2 for each was the a priori measure. So I like that line. But it has a real meaning. The literal meaning of a priori is from what came before. And if you think of an effective 2D field theory, what is a point? It's really a block. Right? It's a block, cutoff by cutoff block. Okay? So the a priori measure for that block is a summary of all the fluctuations at shorter distances. That's a nice physical field for the a priori measure. It's the measure that describes what came before in the sense of the 2D renormalization group, what came at smaller 2D scales. Okay. Both pieces of data in a nonlinear model evolve under the renormalization group. But what I'm interested in is how does the a priori measure evolve? Well, as you move out to larger 2D distance, you have fluctuations. So that a priori measure is going to diffuse. Okay? But at the same time, as you move out in 2D scale, these lambdas are being driven towards beta equals zero. So it's a driven diffusion process. So this a priori measure satisfies a diffusion equation where you're diffusing in the metric on the target manifold, and you're driven by the 2D beta function, which is a function of the lambdas. Okay. Now, and that equation assumes that rho of lambda is a function. So what I did is I wrote the measure as the metric volume element times a function, rho. Now, you see, if beta were 0, you just diffuse to rho equals 1. You diffuse to the Riemannian measure, volume element. And that's what you usually do in a nonlinear model without thinking. But if you read my thesis, I made a strong point that it's dynamically determined by the 2D renormalization group. But here, you're not driven to the Riemannian metric because you have this driving force, beta. And if beta is a gradient vector field on the space, the target manifold, the space of couplings, you're driven to something that has the form of the functional measure of a quantum field theory. If you think of the lambdas as the modes of the space-time quantum fields, okay. So the a priori measure of the lambda model is going to be space-time quantum field theory. And now I've answered that question I had in the late 80s. How does the 2D normalization group produce quantum field theory in space-time? Okay, and I claim that the consistency conditions that I outlined at the beginning are satisfied automatically by the properties of the 2D renormalization group. I won't go into that, but it's very simple arguments in a hand-waving way. Making them precise in detail might take some work. Okay, I've gone way over, so maybe I should leave people to read the rest rather than keep talking. What do you say? You want? I don't have a prediction, but I'll talk about the route towards it. That's the next couple slides. What's the verdict?
Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe you can summarize the most. Where is the prediction? Yeah, where is your.
Okay. The lambda model is producing, the 2D renormalization group of the lambda model is producing this a priori measure, which is the functional integral of a quantum field theory in space time. But it's producing it by a process that looks like stochastic quantization. That stochastic quantization is, you have to put it in two-dimensional field theory terms. So that works if you have a very large target manifold. But you also have the possibility in 2D field theory of semi-classical effects that aren't there in the small lambda fluctuations, namely winding modes in the target manifold. Those would be new degrees of freedom that might participate in this a priori measure. That you'll have degrees of freedom that describe the background now, but they're not small perturbations of lambda. So you ask yourself, what is the winding modes in a 2D field theory, a nonlinear, are pi 1 of the target manifold. And here, the target manifold is the space-time fields. So in the spirit of that conditional prediction, the question is, what is pi 1 of the space of gauge fields in the standard model? And the pi 1 of the space of metrics in the standard model. But I'll concentrate on gauge fields. So we want to know what is pi 1 of the space of SUN gauge fields on R4. That's the space of fields, gauge fields in the standard model for n equals 2 and n equals 3. Okay? Well, the mathematicians know what that is. It's pi k of that space is pi k plus 3 of the group. And so we want k equals 1. We want winding modes. So that's pi 4 of the group. And the only SUN that has a non-trivial pi 4 is SU2, but we're interested in SU2. So there's going to be a winding mode. Okay, and then 2D instantons, that's another non-perturbative effect that could have an influence. That's k equals 2, pi 2 of the target manifold. That's pi 5 of the group, and that's non-trivial for both SU2 and SU3. So we have the possibility of non-canonical interactions. Now, so I was motivated to find out what is that winding mode in SU2 gauge theory. And I didn't know the math literature, so I did it on a computer. But it turns out it was somewhere hidden in the math literature. When I tried to tell mathematicians about it, they said, oh yeah. What it is it's an instanton anti-instanton pair in space-time. So the action is 2 delta, and they're tiny. The action is 2 delta functions. The topological action is 2 delta functions with opposite sign, right? And but they have to coexist. So there has to be a patching matrix, but the patching matrix acts on the gauge field, so it acts in the adjoint. So the patching matrix is in SU2 mod Z2. Okay? So there's a non-trivial loop in that patching matrix between the and the anti. And that is the winding mode of the lambda model if you were in the neighborhood of the standard model. Okay? So it has some really weird, it's very weird. And in some ways, I'm very embarrassed that I'm so slow at trying to figure out how this could affect the standard model. I'm really, it is profoundly embarrassing. If I would be delighted if some younger and more nimble modes would join nimble minds would join in trying to figure it out. But, And I did similar calculations for pi 2 for the 2D instantons. And they're roughly the same, but you need more than 2 instantons to get them. OK, so what's to do? There's lots of foundational stuff. But like I kept saying, who cares unless there's some evidence, right? So the really urgent thing to do is to calculate what this bilocal object might do or would do in correcting the standard model. And I'm not claiming I have any idea now. I'm very embarrassed, but I haven't gotten very far at all in figuring out how to do that. And then I want to make something which I find tantalizing. If you look at how the lambda model works, it works from small 2D distances higher and higher in 2D distance. If you translate that into L, it's implementing the S matrix renormalization group. So it works from big L down to small L. So this mechanism for producing quantum field theory in space-time is operating in a very counterintuitive way, especially to us, those of us who grew up with Wilson. Or maybe you could say people who grew up with Democritus, I don't know. But the idea that the laws of physics could be generated by a mechanism that works from large, but it's not a mystical mechanism. I really want to insist on that. I am terribly devoted to the notion that we need effective mechanism. This is just a 2D field theory that operates from the space-time point of view from big distance down. So all our intuitions about naturalness might be unnatural if this mechanism is correct. I think I said it all that I planned to. There's other stuff in the appendix which you are welcome to read. I think he beat you by a second.
It's more important. I just wanted to ask, where is the string theory in all of this?
The what?
String theory. It seems like, you know...
The string theory is the machine that goes from the effective 2D quantum field theory to a space-time effective S matrix. So it describes short distance scattering.
But do you start with this bosonic string theory?
No. When I say string theory, as I said, you get, you know, you add all these things to this X in order to get, but the main thing is you have to get rid of the tachyon, right? That's the from the point of view of getting an effective machine, I need the beta function to flow to beta equals zero. I can't have any unstable directions, right? So I need the 2D quantum field theories that give you a tachyon-free string S matrix.
Symmetry to the
bulge? Yeah, that's the technique. And then you take the GSO projection and you, okay. And it's not the nicest 2D formalism. I was involved with it in the 80s, and you have all kinds of technical complications doing this. But it has this marvelous property that there are no relevant operators, okay? I mean, if you look at my thesis, you know, from sort of the previous decade, I moan about the unstable directions, because, you know, I came out of Wilsonian stat-mech perspective, and you'll only see what the renormalization. If you have unstable directions, you're not going to see it, right? Unless you are really, really good at experiment, because those are the unstable directions are codimension. You know, if you're anywhere away from the critical surface, you're driven far away. So you have to tune the system. So you know, I was from a stat-mech point of view, the bosonic nonlinear model. You know, without the the original sigma model had O3 symmetry. Or some group symmetry that helped with this problem, but without that, that was one of the main appeals of the string world sheet to me, was it got rid of the unstable 2D directions in the 2D renormalization group. He was in queue.
Somewhere in your formalism, is there a way of trying to beat down, at least, you know, beat down this landscape?
I haven't the faintest. First of all, I have no idea about the validity of the landscape. I have colleagues who poo-poo it. So, I have never bothered to think about it.
I mean,
but I don't care, right? At this point, I don't care because It's debating how many angels can dance on the head of a pin before you've proved that there are angels in the world.
But the thing is that I think it's the wrong approach. That's why. So
I think interactions,
string interactions, is an important aspect of trying to beat the lens. I don't think that's...
Fine. But my goal was, as I described, to have a mechanism that produces quantum field theory and produces an S-make, you know, that formal structure I described. Something very conservative. And then I want to test it by this kind of conditional prediction. Okay, I insist on something practical that might practically be useful. And only then, if it were to pass that test, would I, if I were young enough, worry about all these other possibilities that the conditional ignored. Okay? But it's not just that I don't have time. I don't think the population of even something as big as this institute has time to worry about those questions until there's some evidence. Okay? I don't see how you can answer questions like that.
How do you get the SU3 equals SU2 question?
Like I've been saying, it's a conditional, I'm trying to make conditional predictions.
Yep.
So I'm assuming this lambda model is making a measure on all the backgrounds possible, all the 2D quantum field theories of the world sheet. Okay? Who knows where that measure lives? So I'm assuming, well, let's suppose that some of it is concentrated near a background that looks like the standard model. That's the conditional. Then what would we see that would be beyond the standard model, non-canonical effects? And if one can predict something like that and then check it and it works, then I would worry about, you know, how much of it concentrated in the standard model. You know, what was the probability? You know, I don't know how to, those questions are so grandiose, right? I need some evidence that the language in which to ask them is correct before I'll think about them.
How do you know that you're assuming the 2D is the crime world?
Yeah.
That the 2D quantum field theory.
Yeah.
It's the crime work for all of this.
Yes. I'm building the machine. And as I tried to describe it historically. I don't have any deep principle for saying that 2D renormalization groups should be the machinery. I just came across this clue. Back in the late 70s, the beta function arm u nu equals zero, fixed point equation, and I pursued it. So all I presented this lambda model as a mechanism that produces the minimum we need for a more fundamental theory. I am not claiming it's the only possibility. It's the only one I know of.
I think what Chang is concerned about is where does higher space-time comes about. It's because there is a map from the 2D space-time to the target space-time. So he has target space-time with the G mu and X mu and so on, the pair functions in that map. So he does have.
There's even a more abstract way to say exactly what you said. If you have a 2D quantum field theory with a lot of operators of dimension near zero, if that picture were the case, these would be eigenfunctions of the Laplacian on spacetime, right? But abstractly, if you have them, you can show that their operator product coefficients define a commutative algebra. And so you can play these math games of recreating a space from its functions, Gelfand, right? And you would get a space-time manifold from the abstract 2D field theory. I mean, it's equivalent to what you said. It's just going in the other direction.
So you have the degrees of freedom that talk about the
Yeah, but not every 2D quantum field theory looks like that. There would be other 2D quantum field theories in the scope of this lambda model, which don't look like space-time of any dimension. And the measure, who knows? I mean, I have no argument that the measure is driven to big four manifolds. I mean, again, that's the kind of question I would only ask if I thought the language really did describe the real world. I'm not in the science fiction business.
The problem is that string theory started as being that you're forced to get on top of space. It brings you into higher dimensions. And that has been the activist here.
Oh, yeah. And that's why I'm pushing this notion of a conditional prediction. These suggestions of non-canonical effects, if you assume that you get four large dimensions only, plus with field content equal to the standard model or something reasonably close, and then that's the condition, if you get that, then you will get X, Y, and Z. And if X, Y, and Z can be observed, then it's there. Then I would say, okay, now there's a real mystery. Why aren't we in seven dimensions? Or, you know, right? But for me, the target is to have at least a conditional prediction that can be tested first. Because if it were to be tested and pass the test, I think, you know, that would be pretty compelling evidence that the language has something right to it.
String theory was forced into high dimensions.
Right.
Because of the
right.
Of the
That's one way of saying it. Another way is that it's to get a sensible two-dimensional physics, you need that. Okay.
So what you described with these kind of conditional predictions rhymes a lot with something people now call the swamp land philosophy, sort of the complementary way of looking at the landscape, which is instead of trying to cut down on a set of possibilities for consistent spectacular, you ask what are the conditions that any given theory needs to satisfy for it to be embedded in a more complete description involving strings and so on. So have you read Volition?
No. No, I'm allergic to that whole enterprise. The way you said that, I've heard that word somewhere, but the way, look, I
want. Nobody wants to be the swamp.
No,
I mean, Brian, you might be, which I understand.
I'm trying to be very practical. A conditional prediction is something pretty simple.
Yeah.
You say, if this theory is right, and if it produces the standard model, then it produces proton decay, and you can go and check, and you find it's not there, and then you say goodbye, right?
This idea from what people are calling content is this sort of, it's exactly that. It's just not a nice word, actually. But I mean, they do have certain conjectures and so on. The most famous one called the weak gravity conjecture. I don't know if you ever.
I bridle at, you know, so is some conjecture consistent with certain places in the swampland? Has it got a flavor like that? Who cares? The weak gravity conjecture doesn't mean anything to me. I don't think it means anything to my colleagues in CERN. I want something where the prediction is something an experimentalist can observe. I mean, I haven't mentioned most of mainstream fundamental physics except with the number 45.
What's 45?
Hmm? I made a resolution not to belabor that point.
Thanks.